Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome back to Vashon 250, episode 28. This time we look at the Articles of Confederation, and we're joined by our good friend, Craig Bellis. Adopted on the 15th of November, 1777, and enforced from the 1st of March of 1781 to 1789, the Articles served as the first constitution of the United States, creating a loose League of Friendship among 13 sovereign states with a weak central government.
Yeah, it was drafted by a committee appointed on the 11th of June, 1776, with John Dickinson, an American founding father, lawyer, and politician, as its principal writer. The Articles were formally adopted by the Continental Congress on the 15th of November, 1777, but ratification required all 13 colonies, all 13 states, actually, then, completed when Maryland ratified it on the 1st of March of 1781. There was a reason why they were delayed for so long, and it was the land claims of Virginia. They wanted an incredible amount of land all the way to the Mississippi River and up into northern Michigan. And many of the other states said no. They slowly came along, and Maryland was the last state to ratify it. It was replaced by the U.S. Constitution in 1789, so it was only around for 7 years.
But it's your sense of Virginia's land claims in what was then called the Trans-Appalachian West, was really the western boundaries of the United States. It was before the Louisiana Purchase. And so what you had is what would become the Northwest Territories, or what we call the Old Northwest Territories. Virginia claimed it all.
Right.
and so the other states were saying, wait a minute, let's hold on to this.
And
so
wasn't George Washington part of that discussion as a Virginia landholder?
Well, because he owned a lot of that land, and yeah, he had, in the French and Indian Wars, had been out there and sort of at Fort Pitt. And had bought a lot of that land. So there has been corruption at the top from the very beginning.
So the key features of the articles included the following: state sovereignty. Each state retained its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, with all powers not expressly delegated to Congress. It also brought a structure of government, a unicameral Congress with one vote per state, regardless of population, no separate executive or judiciary at the national level. There was also a, quote, League of Friendship, unquote. States agreed to mutual defense, protection of liberties, and general welfare. And then there were interstate rights, free movement, and equal privileges for citizens across states, with some exceptions.
And there were weaknesses. There were weaknesses because they really formed this this League of Friendship for minimal purposes. The colonies had been around, for some of them, for over 150 years. So they really protected their sovereignty, and they wanted to give the central government as basically only so much power as you absolutely needed in order to engage in a war with Great Britain. And so they lacked the power to tax and regulate commerce. They had no authority to enforce laws or resolve interstate disputes effectively. There was economic instability, and inflation weakened this union. As the government's weaknesses became apparent, Alexander Hamilton and a few other prominent political thinkers in the fledgling Union began asking for changes to the Articles that would strengthen the powers afforded to the central government. But it really was kind of a placeholder for the 7 years that it was in existence.
And it was it was a good start in the sense that it really gave people, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, a sense of how important it is to have some power in the central government, but also to ensure that states have rights. And that becomes one of the central sort of debates, 7 years later when they decide to move toward what we now have as a constitution.
So there are numerous events over the next 250 years of American history that echo the struggle to develop a new government. Bruce, Craig, what are some of the most significant of these historic events?
Well, one of them was the inability of the central government to quell rebellions of various sorts. And Bruce, as you well know, there was the Shays Rebellion, which I think there's a separate episode coming up here in several weeks.
Yep.
And that was 1786 and 1787. There was this this fighting that was going on, and the state did not have the ability to put down, to quell the rebellion, and they thought we really need some central authority in order to do that. So
yeah, we'll come back in episode 39. We'll come back and talk more about Shays' Rebellion, but it was essentially a tax revolt. And what we found was that the Articles of Confederation did not provide any power of the central government to tax or to form a military to respond to something like Shays' Rebellion. We'll dive into that more fully in episode 39, but it really showed the central weakness of the Articles of Confederation and becomes an important part of the thinking of the group who begin to become what we call now Federalists, who are arguing for a stronger federal government versus the anti-federalists who wanted a weak central government.
Yeah, and that battle continues till just right now.
Today.
It's going this on afternoon.
Right now. This afternoon and
right.
Tomorrow.
Yes, right.
It all has to do with the give and take, the power of between the states and the central government. The Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1789 were written by a fellow we all know, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, arguing for a doctrine known as nullification, where the states were not happy with some of the things that the central government was doing. So they felt that because the central government was the product of an agreement, of a contract between the individual states, that the states could nullify what the central government had to say, or the laws that it passed. And we don't have to follow those. We nullify them in our state. And it just, put the tack, right, in the major problem of the relationship between the central government and the states. Who's gonna be supreme?
Yeah, and that argument, if you will, goes on for the next 70 years until the American Civil War. And in many ways, the American Civil War is really over that very issue of nullification, and that's the sense of what ultimately in the Constitution becomes a supremacy clause that sort of grants the federal government supremacy in everything that's not enumerated, given to the states, the powers given to the states.
And that is kind of the compromise, not the Missouri compromise, compromise.
Right.
States, you get everything that we don't get, that aren't specifically addressed, that we get the central government, but everything that we get, all the powers that we have as the central government, we're supreme on.
Yep, exactly.
And you have to follow those.
Yep, exactly. And that sets up a conflict on all kinds of levels, economic, social, political level for the next 70 years.
And including slavery.
And slavery's, in one way, at the heart of it all, because slavery is the great unaddressed question in both the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution. But it's fascinating to see how the Articles of Confederation try and deal with the issue of slavery and the issue of nullification without addressing it directly. You know,
really, I mean, just totally slicing the pie. Or avoidance, one might say.
You cut the baby in half and the baby doesn't survive.
Right.
And that's sort of the Articles of Confederation in many ways.
Well, tell me about the Missouri Compromise.
Well, the Missouri Compromise, 1820, essentially it admitted Missouri as a slave state, ability to carry slavery into Missouri. But at the same time, let Maine come in, because Maine was really part of Massachusetts at that point, but Maine becomes a separate state at that time that prohibited slavery. And so you had one free state, one slave state coming into the Union to keep things balanced.
Was 1820.
1820, yeah.
That's
so
right.
This is 30 years after.
And the North and the South were at odds for many years over this issue.
Yeah. Well, and even back to the Articles of Confederation, and we'll talk more about it when we get to the Constitution, that the whole idea of do enslaved people count as citizens? And, of course, the Constitution writes them out, and that would come up in the Dred Scott decision where the Supreme Court decides that African Americans were never intended to be citizens. And so no matter where you took an enslaved person, that person remained enslaved. The Dred Scott decision, essentially, Dred Scott was an enslaved person who had his owner had moved him into free states and then back to slave states. And he petitioned to be free because he had been in a free state.
Right.
And it sort of sets up that sort of Supreme Court case that decides that African Americans are not citizens, don't have any ability to be citizens, which is really sort of at the heart of what we'll talk about more when we talk about the Constitution with the Three-Fifths Compromise.
Right. The Three-Fifths Compromise being that the slaves, the non-free, were given, three-fifths of a vote, if you will, which made the South more powerful than it would have been had the slaves not been counted at all.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Which was part, and we'll come back and talk more about this when we talk about the Constitution. But you mentioned an early compromise. That was one of the compromises in the Constitution. How do you enumerate population? Because the Constitution decides to have two houses rather than one house in Congress, like the Articles had. And rather than having one vote per state, like the Articles, the Constitution decides to have two senators for every state and a representative for X number of people in each state. Well, who counts as a citizen of a state? And the compromise was the three-fifths. So enslaved people got to count as three-fifths of a person, which from the very beginning, sort of identifies African-American enslaved people as less than citizens and as less than full persons. And that sets up a conflict that ultimately leads to the Civil War.
Right, right.
So that brings us to existing times. This afternoon, among others, what are some of the most significant events in the U.S. during the past 5 or 6 years to balance the power of the federal government with the power of the states?
Well, I think, important to look back and see where the Articles were recreated in this sort of sweep of American history that leads us to where we are today. And, of course, the Civil War itself, when the Confederacy was formed, the constitution of the new Confederacy, breaking away from the Union based on this concept of legal concept of nullification that you find in the Kentucky and Virginia resolves, essentially is a recreation of the Articles of Confederation for this new nation that wants to sort of break away. And the Civil War in many ways has fought over that issue of what does slavery mean and who gets to control enslaved people. So when you bring it up to the present time, what you see, I think, is a continuing effort by states to gain their power, and increasingly strong attempts by the federal government to increase the power of the federal government. And you get into this concept of the imperial presidency that begins to be sort of articulated in the 1980s and 1990s as the power of the presidency grows, the power of the federal government grows. And it's sort of what you see, particularly after the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1953 and other decisions by the Supreme Court that give more and more power to the federal government based on the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment that redefines citizenship. What you see is a reaction by states, particularly those former slave states that were in the Confederacy, to resist that sort of push by the federal government to broaden the concept of equity. And that leads to many of the conflicts that we see over the last part of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, where conservatives in the United States are trying to redefine what it means to be a state power and a federal power. And that leads us to what we see today.
It really comes down to the last 10 years where the Trump administration has taken an assumptive approach on many of these issues of power of the federal government and of the executive branch of the federal government, and said, I'm going to try this and let somebody sue me and let the courts figure it out. Exactly. For example, the whole issue of immigration, this is a classic example, ICE, and then this ICE going into the various cities that they've gone into in Minneapolis and Chicago, et cetera, and asserting themselves there, and then the lack of cooperation by the states in response. Mm-hmm. Sanctuary cities that have been established, the refusal by states and city governments to enforce federal immigration laws, a form of nullification or an attempt at nullification.
Right.
So it's a real push me pull you situation in that regard, and then federal power comes back by trying to cut off funding to those blue cities, those blue states, in response. So you've got quite the teeter totter going on here. Voting, state voting procedures. Now president signed executive orders with regards to, for example, voting rolls.
Mm-hmm.
Got to turn over all your voting rolls, your state voting rolls, to the federal government. Well, he's, I think, lost 21 and won none of right. those cases. But that doesn't stop him from pushing the limits,
right.
pushing the limits, because as you know, many of the federal judges that have been appointed by him, both at the trial court level, the appellate level, and the United States Supreme Court level. I mean, they're all sworn to be neutral, but they're human beings.
Yeah.
Right. And so you're going to have biases there, and we've seen those biases. It is a real battle royale.
Oh, it is. And it's fascinating to me that, we talk about the last 10 years that we're in 2026. 10 years ago was 2016 when Trump first becomes president, his first Trump administration. And so 10 years, you see a significant, what I see as a fundamental flip-flop in this whole concept of states' rights and federal rights, particularly after the Civil War, and particularly after the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, in terms of individual rights, in terms of citizenship, in terms of the power of the federal government, those amendments are designed to clarify the power of the federal government and to clarify individual rights. And so what you get, the pushback against that is a continuation of the pre-Civil War nullification concept and states' rights. And so up into the 1950s and 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, you basically have conservatives arguing for states' rights and liberals, if you will, or progressive arguing for the power of the federal government. Since 2016, that has flip-flopped.
It really is interesting. Conservatives right. versus progressives or liberals, whether you call them Democrats or not, because, of course, Democrats were conservative. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Republicans were more progressive at 1 or 2 points in our history.
Yeah, right.
And clearly the rally cry was states' rights on the conservative side, and now it's central government, the federal government. You know, it's just a fascinating and how there's been movement one way or the other, but that was pretty quick in the last 10 years.
Exactly. And it's that shift in sort of allegiance to states' rights versus federal government rights that has flip-flopped, and flip-flopped particularly quickly in the last 10 years. But you really start to see it with the Reagan Revolution in the 1980s, 1990s. You begin to get that redefinition of the role of the federal government, and the role of the federal government is to be, you know, less intrusive, if you will, and not to sort of dictate to states. Mm-hmm. And what comes out of that, particularly over the last 10 years, as you sort of pointed out, Craig, is states begin to set up themselves as counters to the federal government. One of the things I find is most instructive and sort of emblematic of that is the development of what is called the West Coast Health Alliance. And that's relatively recent. That's the last 2-3 years. As the health department in the United States has been taken over by conservatives and by individuals like RFK who don't value science in the way that traditional health secretaries have.
Particularly relevant in light of the very recent declaration with regards or recommendations with regards to vaccinations of children.
Exactly. And the whole role of the CDC, you know, putting out guidelines, putting out sort of recommendations. You know, the federal government has stepped back from that. So what you get is the governors of California, Oregon, and Washington went together and formed this West Coast Health Alliance, which basically recreated the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, for the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And they put out their own recommendations. The governor of Hawaii, who is a doctor himself, was so impressed that he demanded Hawaii become part of that as well. And so what you have is sort of a state-based Center for Disease Control doing what 20 years ago, the Center for Disease Control did nationally, and is no longer doing. And what you have is the West Coast states saying, okay, we'll just go do it ourselves.
You can find that a similar situation in almost every field where the federal government has expanded its authority, the environment being one of them,
of course. Yep. That's another classic example where environmental law, as the federal government has stepped back from enforcing environmental regulations, you see even red states, relatively conservative states, stepping up and passing their own environmental regulations, because people are very concerned about sort of, maintaining their own environment, Not that they're concerned about the environment of somebody else's
That's
state,
right.
but they're concerned about That's my right. environment.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
So let's, as we always do, wrap this around to events here on our Inner Island community. How does all this echo the national and recent struggles to balance power and decision-making with the power of the county, the state's federal government for right here on Vashon?
Yeah, well, I think, and Craig, jump in, because you've been part of this in the past. I think what's fascinating with Vashon is Vashon is kind of like, a subject state to King County, if you will. We
a
have
vassal state.
Vassal
state. Yeah, I mean, we don't have a voice of our own. We don't have a government of our own, and so we're dependent for most decisions that affect the island. We're most dependent on King County and the state of Washington, and we have representatives, you know, on the King County Council, you know, in the state house and the state senate, but those are only one vote out of larger bodies, and so Vashon really doesn't have a voice. And I think what happened in the past, I'm working with Dr. Bob Hughes, interesting guy here on the island. We're looking at the history of the emergence of the community council, because before the community councils formed in the 1960s, what you have on Vashon is you have special interest groups who provide a voice to King County. So there's things like some of the fraternal organizations, you know, some of the businessmen organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, but they all come with a specific point of view. Nobody really represented the full island. And so in the 1960s with the Jigsaw Plan, which was the first comprehensive plan on Vashon Island, one of the proposals was to develop a community council, a sort of idea based on the town meeting of New England, where everybody has a voice and everybody gets to sort of communicate as an opinion. And that begins then gets transmitted to King County. And Craig, you might want to jump in here. There's been multiple ways that that's tried to sort of form itself.
But King County did form a committee on the island that I and another individual, John Whitlock, chaired to look into governance options for rural King County. And of course, we were sort of the place that they where they thought we might have the most success in coming up with some ideas. And we did surveys, extensive surveys. And it was clear that the people were motivated by three things. They wanted more local control. They wanted more direct democracy. And they wanted to retain the rural nature of Vashon Island. And I think that that has uniformly remained the same for decades and decades. And we looked at everything from forming our own county, which, of course, attempts were made in the last 100 years, to the kinds of enhanced community councils that we had developed at the time. But that's an area that we could have a whole show on.
Yes, we will.
Yeah, we'll come back and talk about that more when we talk about the Constitution in a few weeks. Because, again, it's that sense of how do you have a voice in a structure that doesn't give you a voice?
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been the issue for Vashon Island. And that's why I think, and Bob Hughes and I working together, have both sort of come to the conclusion that the attempt to form a community council was incredibly revolutionary at its time in the 1960s. It was really the first time that Vashon sought a voice of its own outside of breaking away from King County. And there's a whole history there that we've talked about in the past and we'll talk about in the future.
All right. With that, thanks for joining us. Thanks to our partners at the Vashon Heritage Museum for contributing to this. And Craig, it's always a pleasure to have you as well. Bruce and I look forward to our next episode when we'll be joined by historian Nancy Bristow, and we'll discuss Valley Forge and the challenges faced in the winter of 1777-78. See you next time.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.